Pidyon Abed, the idea that the Torah community and that the figures of the Torah community continue from one generation to the next, able to speak from one generation to the next. And that there is a continuous conversation, there is a community of the Masorah community of Torah that continues from one generation to the next. And at the very end of that beautiful piece, and if anyone wants to read it or to hear it, I believe it's on YU Torah, and I'm more than happy to send out a link if you would like. Please feel free to reach out. But at the very end, Rav Soloveitchik, again, I'm doing it no service because Rav Soloveitchik said so much of it was just to hear his tone and to hear the words. But Rav Soloveitchik at the very end describes that there is a baby at this Pidyon HaBen, and he says, I'm not sure if I will be Zocha, if I will have this baby in my class. But I know that there will be Rebbeim, there will be Talmid, there will be students of mine who will be able to teach that baby and will continue the Masorah community. And what a privilege it was in that moment to be able to declare to the room that us, our class of Rabbanim, of this yeshiva, at the Chag HaSmicha, are the babies, so to speak, of that generation, and that we have been zocha to learn from all of our Rosh Yeshiva and have totally benefited, not only individually, but as a collective, from our Rosh Yeshiva. And amongst, not amongst, but above, really, in all situations, Rav Schechter, I think many of us understood this in a deeper way, specifically throughout COVID, is that the entire community leaned on Rav Schechter in so many difficult and complicated Shilos community systems and community decisions. Everyone, the name Rav Schechter, again, forgive me, everyone was, Rav Schechter says that, Rav Schechter, and there were Shilas and Tshuvos coming out on a constant basis. And while so much of the world was saying COVID, 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 our community was saying, Rav Schechter was saying this, and Rav Schechter was saying, and what is zechus it is that we have tonight to have Rav Schechter in our Beis Medrash together with us this evening to share words of Torah. I just want to share that it is a remarkable zechus for each and every one of us, and a huge thank you on behalf of our entire community, Rav Schechter, for carrying all of us, for carrying our extended communities on your shoulders in so many circumstances, and as we started with, carrying on that torch of Rav Soloveitchik, sharing to that baby, saying, I know that confidence that the next door of Rabbanim, the next door of Rosh Yeshiva will share the Torah with the next. We are, Chevra, we are the babies in that conversation. And Rav Schechter is continuing that opportunity for us to connect to his Rebbe, to Rav Soloveitchik, and to so many Doros before us. What an opportunity it is to be in his presence, and an opportunity it is to learn Torah from Rav Schechter tonight. Thank you so much. And without further ado, Tznu Kabbalah Torah. Please welcome Rav Schechter.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. When I was a little boy, they used to ask a riddle at that time to the young children. They would say, they got archaeologists were digging in the Nile River and they found the bones.
Okay, report?
Yes. They found the bones of 7 cows. So they would ask us, do you think those are the bones of the fat cows or the bones of the 7 skinny cows? So the brighter little children would say it has to be the bones of the skinny cows because the skinny cows ate up the fat cows. And the correct answer is that the whole thing was a dream. There are no bones. The whole story is all a dream. It never happened. There were no bones. There was no cows. But there are other things in the Chumash that we know did happen. Avraham Avinu was a real person. Yitzchak, Yankov were real people who really existed. In the Middle Ages, in the days of the Rashba, there were many Jews who were so into Greek philosophy and general philosophy that they were interpreting everything in abstract terms. So they came up with the idea that Avraham Avinu was a concept, Yitzchak represents another concept, Yankov represents a concept. They weren't real people. So the Rashba says that's not true. We have a historical tradition that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yankov really existed. The bones of the cows never existed. That was just a dream. The Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim that when Yankov Avinu was fighting with the angel, that was only a dream. That was a Mara HaNevuah. It never really happened. So the Ramban, in his commentary on Chumash, quotes this from the Rambam, and he says, how can it be? But it says that after the fight was all over, Yankov Avinu was limping. because the angel broke his legs. If the whole thing was a dream, so why is he limping? So the Ritva has a sefer where he comes to defend the Rambam from many of the kashas of the Ramban. He says there's such a thing as a psychosomatic sickness, because he had this frightening dream that he was fighting with the Malach, and the Malach in the dream broke his leg. So when he woke up from the dream, he was limping for a while. But it really never happened. The whole thing was just a dream. And the Ramban thinks that it really happened. We're not sure whether it really happened or not. The Chumash tells us in Parshas Balak that Bilam was carrying on a conversation with his mule, with his asam. Piha asam. Yiftach Hashem is piha asam. So the Rambam says that it never really happened. It was just a Mara HaNevuah. The Mishnah says not so. Mishnah Pirkei Avos says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Erev Shabbos Bein HaShmoshes and Sheshes Mei Breishes. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the Piha Asan and the bear and the man, all the nisim that are going to occur in the future. Everything was instilled into nature from the very outset, Erev Shabbos Bein HaShmoshes. So the Rambam must have some other source if he wants to say not like the Mishnah. That's a question. We're not sure whether the Asan really spoke to Bilam or not. Or let's say Eov, the Gemara has a discussion. One opinion, the Tanoim weren't sure whether the story of Eov really happened or it's just a novel. So one Tanoim is of the opinion, the whole story never happened. It was a novel that was written by Moshe Rabbeinu to bring out certain ideas. Because the friends who come to be Menachem Avil, who come to speak to Eov, they speak in such a fancy language. That's what they really said. So that's why one Tana was motivated to say his tradition was that the whole thing is a novel. The others say, no, there was a real person, and it says what his name was and what country he came from and so on. They really happened. We're not sure. But other things we know for sure that they happen. The basis of our religion, the foundation of our religion, is based on the two major events of Yetzias Mitzrayim and Maimon HaSinai. HaKadosh Baruch Hu proclaimed in advance that he's going to do Nisim in Mitzrayim, Man Teidu Ki Ani Hashem. The Nisim were in order to demonstrate to all of the Jewish people all of the 13 Ikari HaAmunah of the Rambam. That God exists and He is in full power of everything. He knows everything that's happening. People have Bechira Chavshis. There's Schar V'Yonesh and there's Nevuah. And if there's Nevuah, if God can communicate with man, man can communicate with God. So included in the principle of Nevuah is the principle of Tefillah. There can be communication in both directions and so on. That's the idea of the mitzvah of Sipei Tzias Mitzrayim every day. Every day we just mention Tzias Mitzrayim briefly. On Pesach night we give Kol Amar B'Lasapa. We tell a long story. So the whole significance of Sipei Tzias Mitzrayim, we shouldn't forget L'man Teidu Ki'ani Hashem, that all of the Ikuri HaMunah were demonstrated with the Esa Makas and the Kriyas Yamsuf of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And then the second event was Maimon HaSinai. These two major events, there's a mitzvah to speak about Yetzias Mitzrayim. There's a mitzvah to speak about, to read once a year, every year, about Maimon HaSinai. We read three times a year. We read in Parshas Yisro, in Parshas Vayeshanan, and then on Shavuos we read a third time. The reason why there's a special mitzvah to read these sedras, because all of the Ikari HaMunah were demonstrated to the Jewish people at that time. We live in a generation that people don't know what's true, what's not true. We have historical traditions. I knew my four grandparents. In fact, there was a period of time my family lived in Philadelphia, and the day school there only went, the day school was called Beth Jacob, it was co-ed, only went to the fifth grade. So my parents had to send me to New York to stay by my grandparents in order to go to yeshiva here in the sixth grade on. Then my parents moved to New York before my bar mitzvah. So I knew both of my grandparents, my father's parents, my mother's parents. They knew their parents and their grandparents all the way back. And we know that, our parents didn't tell us lies. They're not going to tell us the story that Santa Claus is going to climb through the chimney, he's going to leave presents. Sometimes they tell the story, then tell us it's a joke, it's a Baba Meisa, but they're not going to tell us the story and make believe that it's true if they know that it's not true. Our parents were not liars. Our ancestors would be Meisa Nefesh. They would give up their lives for the principles of the Jewish religion. We're not talking about Bava Mises. We're talking about the fact there were Shishim Ribo Jewish men between the age of 20 and 60 on the occasion of Yetzias Mitzrayim. There were probably six, there were Shishim Ribo women also. There were people younger than 20, many of you are young, people older than 60. I mentioned I'm older than 60. Then there was Erev Rav. There were several million people who were the original generation. The Dor of Yetzias Mitzrayim was the original generation of the Jewish people. And they transmitted everything that they saw, Yetzias Mitzrayim, Maimon HaSinai. They told them everything to their children. And all of this is historical records. It's not that we have faith that we believe in this story. We believe that what our parents told us, and they told us that they're prepared to give up their lives on these Ikari Hamunah. They're prepared to be Moshe Nefesh. Many of them were Moshe Nefesh. Many of them were Moshe Nefesh. Because they said, these are the stories that are true. This is what absolutely happened. Similarly, we believe, it's not an Amunah, we believe this is a historical record that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down the entire Torah. And the Torah was dictated to Moshe Rabbeinu word for word and letter for letter. The Gemara learns that din from the fact that the word is sometimes spelled mole, sometimes spelled chaser. The word na'aro, when it appears in Chumash, most of the time is spelled nun ayin resh. Once in a while it's spelled nun ayin resh hey. That's the way we spell it today. The Gemara learns that din from the fact that here it's spelled mole, here it's spelled chaser. The word tahor is often, most of the time, spelled tes hey vav resh, and sometimes spelled tes hey resh. The Gemara learns out of din from the fact that it's missing a vav. So we believe the Torah was dictated to Moshe Rabbeinu word for word, letter for letter. The Gemara will learn adinim from the fact that there's an extra phrase in a pasuk, there's a missing phrase. What are you learning adinim? If it was written by human beings, what are you learning? We believe Moshe Rabbeinu told us. The people saw the way he was, people heard when Moshe Rabbeinu was delivering the Nevuah to Bnei Yisrael, it wasn't his voice. Moshe Rabbeinu was a kvad peh, kvad loshen. He wasn't a good speaker at all. He had no loudspeaker. How could all the people hear him? It says, well, yim yanenu b'kol. Our historical tradition is that it wasn't his voice. This is all a historical tradition, the truth of the Torah. And our ancestors were prepared to give up their lives on Torah Shebal Peh. Torah Shebal Peh is not written down, but everything was transmitted from generation to generation. When we ask a shayla b'Talmud Chacham, the psak is binding on the assumption that Soid Hashem Lireya, the pasuk in Tehillim says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will reveal the secrets of his Torah to the Talmid HaChachamim. It's not a magical thing. It's not like an oracle. By the Greeks, they had magical oracles. It's not an oracle. You have to ask a person who's knowledgeable. You have to ask a person who's a Yirei Shamayim. So it Hashem Lireya. You have to ask a Yirei Shamayim. You have to a person who learned. If a person didn't learn, it's going to be a miracle if he's going to come up with the right answer. The Mishnah says, thank you. Mishnah says, Asei l'charav, Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, Asei l'charav, you have to pick a Talmid Chacham to Paskin Yerusha. It has to be a knowledgeable Talmid Chacham who's a Yirei Shamayim. Then you have the right to rely on the Pasuk. Sod Hashem Nireya. The psak of the Talmid Chacham is binding because we assume that he's not making a mistake. If it's a Bezna HaGadol, whose psak is binding on all of Klal Yisrael, so then the Torah tells us that the Bezna HaGadol has to convene in the Beis HaMikdosh. So the Ramban explains in this commentary on Chumash, why is that so? Why do you need the first Rashi on Parshas, Mishpatim, quotes from the Mechilta, he needs Sanhedrin Samach HaMizbeach. The end of Parshas Yisro speaks about Mizbeach, Mizbeach Avonim Tasali, and then on Mizbeach Adonim Tasali, and then beginning of Mishpatim talks about Bezna, about Sanhedrin. So the connection between the two is, the Mechilta says that you need Sanhedrin Samach HaMizbeach. Why so? So the Ramban says, because the Psak of the Bezna Gadol is binding on all of Klal Yisrael, so we want the Bezna Gadol to meet in the Lishkas HaGozes, in the Beis HaMikdash, near the Mizbeach, near the Hashuas HaShchina. They should have a Siyata Rishmaya, not to make a mistake. But we assume that it's not only the Bezna Gadol who's paskening for all of Klal Yisrael. Any local Orthodox rabbi, we assume the psak is binding because we assume he's not making a mistake. If he's making a mistake, we don't listen to the psak. I remember once, there was a period of time that I used to daven in the Aguda in Washington Heights. there was politics going on in the yeshiva, so I didn't want to get involved in the politics. I dam ne'agudah. So in the Aguda, Rabbi Perlo, the one who just passed away last year, was the head of Broya's yeshiva at that time. He was the Rosh Yeshiva in Broya's. And whoever their practice was, whoever was the Rosh Yeshiva in Broya's, was officially the rabbi in the Aguda shul. What was the function of the rabbi? So one of the functions was that he would bench Rosh Chodesh. He didn't have a good voice, so he wasn't a bal tefillah, but he benched Rosh Chodesh. So I remember on one occasion he made a mistake. He said, Rosh Chodesh is going to be on Wednesday. Everybody screamed out Thursday, so he corrected it. Rosh Chodesh is going to be on Thursday, fine. So I was sitting next to a big fat yekke, and he says to me in German, Rabbi Breuer was still alive. Rabbi Breuer died at the age of 98. So this yekke says to me in German, if this would have happened in the big shul, Rosh Chodesh would have been on Wednesday. I mean, Rabbi Breuer was a real rabbi. This Rabbi Perlo, he's a pushover. He makes a mistake, so you don't follow. If you're a real rabbi, you listen to the psak, even if it's an error. There is no such thing. If a rabbi made a mistake, the psak is not binding if it's an error. Some people think if any product has a hechsher on it, whether the rabbi who endorses the kashrus is reliable or not, I can eat the product because the rabbi said that it's kosher. And if he's not a reliable rabbi, he'll burn in Gehenna for giving the hechsher. But it's okay, I'm allowed to eat because it's a psak. That's ridiculous. If I know that the person is not reliable, I can't rely on his hashgachas, so I can't eat the food. A psak has to be emes. If the psak is not emes, it's not binding. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees to it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees to it that the psak will be a correct psak over the generations. You look in the Shulchan Aruch, you look in the commentaries on the side, in every generation, they often disagreed with what it says in Shulchan Aruch. We don't always follow what it says. The Mishnah Brura, the Chavetz Chaim had a whole project, he had a whole group of people from his family, wrote the whole Mishnah Brura. He reversed the Psak HaMekubal on every single page in Shulchan Aruch. He was a holy tzaddik, so he got away with it. And everybody, all the yeshiva boys in Europe, everybody went to the Chavetz Chaim for a bracha, that they should be potter from the army, they should be potter from the draft. Many of them learned through... When they were younger, they spent time in Radin learning in his yeshiva. Everybody had connection with the Chofetz Chaim. So after the war, when there was such a churban, after the Second World War, there was such a churban HaTorah. And the Talmidei Chachamim who learned in yeshivas as teenagers, they learned in yeshivas in Europe. They're the ones who rebuilt the Torah in America and Eretz Yisrael, all over the Europe and South Africa and so on, all over the world. So they all had a connection with the Chofetz Chaim. So that's why the Mishnah Berurah became so popular. So the Mishnah Berurah reverses the Psak HaMekubal on every page. He disagrees a lot of times what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. Then the Chazon Ish came along. He disagrees a lot of times with things that it says in the Mishnah Berurah. You don't always follow one Pesach. There's no one Pesach who's always right in all cases. Sometimes you follow the Mishnah Berurah, sometimes the Chazon Ish, sometimes the Bogar Avram, sometimes the Taz. Over the generations, the consensus of Klal Yisrael determines, the consensus of Talmid Chachamim determines which is the correct psak. And because of this concept, that Sad Hashem Direya, the psak of the Talmid Chacham is binding, because we assume it's correct, because we assume HaKadosh Baruch will give him a siyata rishmaya, not to make a mistake. So that's what led the Chachamim to believe that many times, not always, many times when you have a dispute between two Talmidei Chachamim, let's say you have many disputes between the Beis Shammai and the Beis Hillel. So the Gemara says a statement, Eilu v'eilu dibra dekim chayim. What do you mean, Eilu v'eilu dibra dekim chayim? Means if you... Well, we don't pass on like Beis Shammai. What do you mean, dibra dekim chayim? Means if you spend time learning the Shittas Beis Shammai, that doesn't constitute Bittul Torah. That's considered Torah, and that's considered Talmud Torah. You're fulfilling Talmud Torah. Even though you know in advance that we don't pass on like that, it doesn't mean that it's wrong. We haven't accepted that opinion. That's what it means. Because the Chachamim was so convinced of this idea, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a divine assistance to the Talmidei Chachamim to make sure that they don't make a mistake. So how can it be HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave a divine assistance to Beis Shammai to say one way, gave a divine assistance to Beis Hillel to say the other way? So the answer is, they're both correct. How can they both be correct? How is that possible? So that Gemara appears in first parak in Erevin, Eilu Eilu Dibur Kim Chaim, the original statement is in connection with the Beis Shammai and the Beis Hillel. So the Ritva has a famous comment on that Gemara, and that's the generally accepted pshat that we assume today. That when Moshe Rabbeinu was on Har Sinai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling him over all the dinim, So Rabbi Yisrael told him, let's say Hilchos Shabbos. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, what's a din in this case? HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, that's not allowed. What's a din in that case? That's permissible. What's a din in this case? That's a great area of halacha, elements of heter, elements of iser. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I leave it up to the discretion of the Talmidei Chachamim and each generation, based on their perspective of Kol HaTorah Kula, whether they think the elements of heter outweigh the elements of iser, or the elements of iser outweigh the elements of heter. So that's how the Ritva understands. Eilu v'eilu divili kimchai. The different perspectives are all correct. I'm looking in a room here with a lot of students and fixtures on the ceiling and bookcases over there, books over here. Although I have one perspective. Someone sitting in the corner over there sees exactly the same, but with a totally different perspective. Someone in that corner sees everything exactly the same, but a different. You're looking from a different angle. You look from a different perspective, so it looks a little different. So there could be many different perspectives of the Torah. And all the perspectives are correct. How can you say it's incorrect? All the perspectives are correct. That's what it means. Doesn't mean that you have the right to follow whichever opinion you want to. No, we don't paskin like Beisham. The Gemara said, Beisham b'mabakam esilu eina mishnah. We don't even consider a slight suffix koldahu. Sometimes in Hilchos Avelos, we're mekel. If there's any slight suffix, whenever it's Beisham against Beisil, we don't consider Beisham shita at all. Halacha l'maisa. But it still constitutes a heftza shel Torah. What is in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah if you discuss the opinions of Bisham? Because they base their opinions on the Yud Gimel Midrashar Torah Nidreshes Behem. But that's why that's considered Torah. You have a pasuk in Parshas Bereishis where the Torah says, Zeh Sefer told us Sodom, etc. So the simple translation of the pasuk sounds like it's telling us that the Bible is a history book of mankind. The Bible, the Chumash, a history book of mankind, very poorly written. Things are not in chronological order. Missing a lot. A lot of stories are exaggerated. So the Chumash writes that someone did an Avera, that was an exaggeration. He didn't do that. So what kind of a history book is that? So the Gemara says that's not what it means. Zeh Sefer told us what it means. HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed Adam HaRishon. He laid out for him everything that's going to happen in the future of the world, in the future of the Jewish people, in the future, the development of the Torah. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed Adam HaRishon, Sifra Shel Adam HaRishon, and has in every generation how the halacha is going to be developed. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees to it behind the scenes that the Torah should be developed in the direction that he wants. People are human beings. They can make mistakes. We don't believe in any human being's infallibility. But the Abdi Avodah Zarah, they have a principle of infallibility by the Pope. We don't have such a thing. We have an institution in the Chumash, or Par Halam Dovar Shel Tzibur, that if the entire Bezna Gadol, the 71 members of Bezna Gadol, vote unanimously to permit something, and then 51% of the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael violated an Issa Koris because of the mistaken Pesach of the Bezna Gadol, so they have to bring a special Korban Chatos. We don't require each and every individual person to bring a chatos. Everybody gets a kapor with the monchat. Probably never happened in the history of the world. All 71 members are going to make a mistake, and the Jews are going to listen to the mistake. The Jews are going to listen to a mistake in Pesach, and then they're going to argue with the Rabbanim if the Rabbanim say something stupid. So it probably never happened in the history of the world. It's very far-fetched. But on the books, is it such a din? Because we don't believe in any human being infallible. Moshe Rabbeinu made mistakes. The Chumash says Aaron HaKohen had a debate with him, and then Moshe Rabbeinu gave in. You're right. Moshe Rabbeinu can make mistakes. We don't have such a principle of infallibility. So why is the Torah binding? The answer is because Sod Hashem Lirach, because Baruch is going to see to it that over the generation the Psak will go in the direction that he wants. So the Gemara says some of the Chachamim had access to this Sifra Shalot HaMarishon. Rabbi Yudan Nasi didn't have access. Rabbi Yudan Nasi was the one who edited the Mishnais. He didn't have access. So the Gemara says that Rab and Shmuel were both learning in Eretz Yisrael, and they were learning, and there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, a very important mitzvah, maybe in our generation, more important than in many generations before. All the Jews were all supposed to live in Eretz Yisrael, but not supposed to be here. So Rab and Shmuel were living in Eretz Yisrael, learning in Eretz Yisrael. They both decided they're moving to Bavel to establish yeshivas because there wasn't enough learning. The Jews in Bavel were very religious, but they were big amaratzim. So they were violating Shabbos and Kashrus, Taras HaMashbacha. They didn't know the dinim. So Rav and Shmuel both went to Bavel, and each one established a big yeshiva in a different city. And the Gemara says the learning picked up tremendously. Rav and Shmuel were the first generation of Amoraim, and then the whole Talmud Bavli was developed from their Talmidim, and so on. So the Gemara says that Rav wanted to get smicha before he leaves. He can't confer smicha on someone who's not yet. The one who's conferring the smicha and the one who's receiving the smicha both have to be in Eretz Yisrael. So Rav went to Rabbi Yudah Nasi and he received smicha. Shmuel wanted also to get smicha. He was also very learned, a contemporary of Rav, Rabbi Shmuel. So one thing came up one day, next day another thing, and then the boat was leaving, so he had to leave. He never got smicha. Once he left Eretz Yisrael, he couldn't get smicha. So Rabbi Yudah Nasi felt very bad about that. Why only Rav was zeicha to get smicha and Shmuel didn't? So they told him, don't feel bad. We saw the Sifra Shalot and Marish, and it says there they're going to be two Talmid HaChachamim in a generation, Rav and Shmuel. Rav is going to get smicha, and Shmuel will not get smicha. That's the Rabban Shalom's plan in the world. And the Gemara says part of that Sifra Shalot and Marish is that says, Ravina Rav Ashi Soif HaRua. That's the end of the Iker of the Torah Shebaal Peh. The Torah Shebaal Peh was always transmitted from generation to generation orally. There was a din dvarim shebaal peh, yata rasha liyomim b'ksav. It does mean that you're not allowed to write down the Torah shebaal peh. The Rambam quotes from the Gemara that in every generation, when the Chachamim heard a new din that they never heard of before, they would write it down to make sure they don't forget. They had private notes. But when they gave a shir, when they gave a public lecture, they wouldn't have everybody read from a text like we do today. Today we teach Mishnayos, or we teach Gemara, we teach Shulchan Aruch. So everybody has the same text and we're reading. So that's what the Gemara said, that's what you weren't supposed to do. But in the later generations, they saw the whole Torah is going to be forgotten if we're going to insist on transmitting everything orally. So based on the Pasuk, Eslas Lashem, Eferet Teresecho, they allowed the writing down of the Torah Shebaal Peh. What does that mean is another discussion. How are you allowed to do an Avera? That's a different story. So, till the days, we assume Rabbi Ranasi edited the Mishnayos. Did he write down the Mishnayos? Most assume the Mishnayos were still being recited orally. They memorized all the Mishnayos. Mishnayos wasn't written down. Most Achrayim and most history books and some of the Mishnayos were not written down by Rabbi Yudah HaNasi. It wasn't written down until the days of Rabbeinu Rav Ashi. Rabbeinu Rav Ashi were the ones who edited the Talmud Bavli, but again, the Talmud Bavli was not written down at that time. Talmud Bavli was written way later in the days of the Gaonim. And they had a big dispute to have the correspondence. It was available in print. They had a big dispute, should they allow the writing down in the Talmud Bavli? The mazel is that they wrote it down. If they wouldn't have written it down, everything would have been forgotten. How is it possible to memorize the whole Talmud Bavli? And the way we have the Talmud Bavli, the Gemara a lot of times has two versions. Did Rabbeinu Rav Ashi say this, or did they say that? Did they say mutter, did they say aser? What do you mean? They're the ones who wrote the Talmud Bavli. No, they didn't write. They edited the Talmud Bavli, and it was being recited orally for generation after generation. And then there were a lot of sfeikas. Who said it, and did he say it's mutter, did he say it's aser, under these conditions, not under those conditions. There are a lot of sfeikas in the Gemara, because the Talmud Bavli was not written down in the earlier generation. So the Gemara says, up until the generation of Rabbeinu Rav Ashi, the whole Torah Shebaal Peh was still being transmitted Baal Peh. So the Chachmei HaMasorah, Chachmei HaMasorah means though to transmit the Torah Shebaal Peh, Chachmei HaMasorah had the full status of Chachmei HaMasorah, because they're receiving the Torah Baal Peh and transmitting it Baal Peh. Till the days of Rabbeinu Rav Ashi, the Gemara has the expression from the Sifra Shalot HaMarishim, Rabbeinu Rav Ashi, Sof HaRo. That's the end of the period when there was the full strength of the Torah Shebaal Peh being transmitted Baal Peh. And those who come in later generations have no right to disagree with those in the earlier generations. From the days of Yeshua Ben Nun till the days of Rabbeinu Rav Ashi, everyone has a right to disagree with everybody else. Usually we assume that Amoraim didn't disagree with Tanoim, but that's not a din. That was, if they could see, if a Shaila came up and they can see Panim Lakan and Panim Lakan, even if they thought that it makes more sense to say one direction, but if they hear all the Tanoim say the other way, so they'd usually give in. They're not going to take on, not going to disagree with all the Tanoim. But on some occasions you find that the Amoraim have no one to rely on, they just disagree with all the Tanoim. There is no din that Tanoim, Amoraim have no right to disagree with Tanoim. That was the attitude that they have. They're not going to take everybody on. So it says in Shulchan Aruch, let's say somebody today, Shulchan Aruch was written in the 1500s, so the Ramah quotes then, he quotes from earlier Apostle. Someone today wants to disagree with the Tshuvas HaGaonim. The Gaonim were before the days of Rashi and Tosfos. So the Rama says, it's a risky step to take. He may be making a major mistake, so you better consult with your contemporaries and present to them what your arguments are, what your proof is, why you think the Gaon made a mistake. But if after presenting to your contemporaries, they're all convinced that you're right, you have a right to disagree with the Gaon, and just like Amoraim have a right to disagree with Tanoim, so Achrayim have a right to disagree with Rishonim, have a right to disagree with Gaonim as well. But those who came after Rabbeinu Rav Ashi have no right to disagree with those who came before. We can't disagree with the Psak and the Talmud Bavli, because that's what it says in Sifrei Shelot HaMarishon. Rabbeinu Rav Ashi, Sof HaRuah, the full status of Bali Masora, Chachmei HaMasora, was from the days of Yishuv Ben Nun till the days of Rabbeinu Rav Ashi, when the Torah Shel Baal Peh was being transmitted Baal Peh. But in the later generations, there's still a Masora of Torah Shel Baal Peh, but Al Pi Din it's a lower level of Masora, because we teach in class, we don't teach lecture style. We read the Mishnahs, we read the Gemara, we read the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, and we teach by reading from a text. So we're transmitting Torah Shel Baal Peh mitoch haksav, which is a lower level Al Pi Din of Balei HaMasora. So that's why the accepted in Shulchan Aruch, accepted Psak is, the one today has no ability to argue with those who came before. But again, the Psakim are binding because we assume that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a divine assistance, gives us the eye to Dishmai to Paskin properly. Story told about the Nari Behuda. Nari Behuda was a very prominent rabbi, lived in the 1700s. So on one occasion, he was first a rabbi in a little village. He was a cousin by marriage of the Baal Shem Tov. He was opposed to the Chassidish movement, so he had a sokim he liked. They got along well. He liked the Baal Shem Tov, but he didn't. He was unhappy with the founding of the Chassidish movement. So a lot of stories about that. But then he was appointed the rabbi in the big city in Prague. So on one occasion, a couple of months after he was appointed rabbi in the big city, they came from the slaughterhouse with the Shaila. There are a lot of details in Hilchos Treifos. What kind of a disease, or let's say the organ, the inner organ, sometimes are punctured. There's a hole in an organ or something, so sometimes they'll make the animal a treifos, sometimes not. So they ran from the slaughterhouse with an organ inside the animal, with a shaila to the rabbi whether it's a treifa or not. So the Nari Behuda looked at it, and he knew the Gemaras, and he knew the Shulchan Aruch, he was a major poisek. And the Gemara never discusses this case. The Gemara never discusses the discussion. If the Gemara says it's treif, treif, but if it's not treif, then it's automatically kosher. But he didn't have the heart to say, he didn't feel comfortable to say that it's kosher. And he felt very uncomfortable, because he always had a comfortable feeling when he gave a psak that he has a divine assistance not to make a mistake. On this occasion, he felt lost. Why do you feel lost? He knows that the Shaila doesn't appear in the Gemara. So it's kosher by definition. So he took the Yerideya and started flipping the pages. He knew he wouldn't find it in the Yerideya. He was trying to stall for time to try to figure out why does he feel so uncomfortable. Then he looked at the people who brought the Shaila. So he slammed shut the Shulchan Aruch and he pointed to one of them. And he said, it's a fake Shaila. You punctured the hole after the Shechita. Usually you can tell. Because if the hole was developed while the animal is alive, then it's going to have blood all around it, because the blood is going to be leaking. If the hole was made after the animal was dead already, then there isn't going to be any blood. But it was true, though, that they punctured the hole right after the Shechita, so they made it look like it happened in Mechaim. And he was screaming at one of the Balabatim, you made up the Shaila, you made the hole after the animal was already dead, and it's not a Shaila. So he screamed so loud till the Balabas admitted that it was the truth. So yes, and how did you know? So he said, because he always has this comfortable feeling when he gives a psak, he feels that he has a divine assistance in giving the psak, and now he felt completely lost. So he felt Kodesh Baruch only gives this Siyata Dishmaya if it's necessary, if there's no Shaila. So he's not going to give us Siyata Dishmaya. So he's trying to figure out, why is there no Shaila? But they brought a Shaila. So when he was appointed just a few months earlier, he was appointed rabbi. In Europe, whenever they would appoint a new rabbi, so there was always a big machloikis, because there was always some balabatim in the community who wanted their son-in-law, or their cousin, or their uncle to be appointed rabbi. So that one of the balabatim came with the shaila, was on the tzad shekeneged. He was supporting a different candidate for the position. and the Rabbanus and Nadi Behuda felt he's probably one who made up the whole Shaila, probably brought the other Balabatim to show that the rabbi doesn't know how to learn, doesn't know how to paskin, because he can't come up with an answer, he can't find it in the Shulchan Aruch. And that was the truth, that they made up the Shaila. We assume, the Gemara says, we assume Talmid, the Psak of a Talmid Chochm is binding, because we assume that it's a correct Psak. And if one rabbi paskin, two qualified rabbis, one rabbi paskin is Mutter, one rabbi paskin is Osir, we assume that each one got a Siyata Rishmaya to paskin his way. That's what it means. Eilevi, Eilevi, Relikim Chayim. You don't always have to have a Psak all of Klal Yisrael in recent years, because we have telephones and because we have email and everything. So they had a practice that anywhere in the world, anyone had a Shaila, they would call right away Rabbi Yashiv in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yashiv with paskin. Everybody has to follow Rabbi Yashiv. That was never the practice. Rabbi Chaim Moshe had a telephone. They didn't call Rabbi Chaim Moshe with every shayla. Every rabbi in a little village, they would tell me the chacham, they would paskin what they think is correct. If there would be friction in the community, it says, if there's a machlekes and it's causing friction, dibrei ribus bisharecha, and they can't resolve it, so then you have to ask the Bez Nagodol. Whatever they paskin, everyone has to follow. You're not allowed to disagree with the psak of the Bez Nagodol. But you don't bring every shayla to the Bez Nagodol. There's nothing wrong with having in one community they follow the psak of their rabbi, the other community they follow the psak of the other rabbi. That's what it means. The Gemara says the Beishamai were outvoted, but the Talmid of Beishamai were obligated to follow the psakim of their rabbeim. The din is everyone has to follow the psak of his rabbi Muvak. There's nothing wrong with following Beishamai. But those who are Talmidim Abisil have to follow their Rebbe, the Beisil Psak. Those who are Talmidim Abishama have to follow Beishamai Sheet. Those who are neither the Balabatim, who neither Talmidim Abishama nor Beisil, so they follow the majority. So the majority was Beisil. So that's why the Psak of Beisil is binding on everyone. But those who learned by Beishamai, the Gemara says, Yosef Beishamai Kedirem, they're obligated to follow the Psak of their Rebbe, even though he was in the minority. That's my Rebbe Muvak, so I have to follow that Psak. How much significance do we place on precedent? I remember when I was in high school, the Eichmann trials were taking place. So we used to watch every day on TV, the Eichmann trials. I remember when Gideon Hausner was the prosecutor for the case for Eichmann. So he quoted a decision from a judge in Idaho. So he didn't know how to pronounce Idaho. So he pronounced, he's speaking in Hebrew, so he said, Idaho. So the judge on the case said, Tagid, Idaho. You have to pronounce it correctly, Idaho. He never heard of the shikra of a judge, didn't know how to pronounce Idaho, and is quoting a precedent. In halacha, if you quote somebody that I never heard of, it's irrelevant. We don't always follow precedent. The Talmid Chacham have to work out the dinim. The Rambam very often quotes things from the Gaonim, the day who followed the Chachmei HaGemara, the Gaonim who were in the two yeshivas in Surah and Nardo in Bavel, and he often disagrees with the Gaonim. Ram doesn't always feel obligated to follow precedent. That's the idea of Eilev Yeleh Dibilikim Chaim. The Talmid HaChachamim in every generation, right, titled, they're obligated to express the honest to goodness opinion, to say what they think the din is, the psak is. Moshe Feinstein very often disagrees with the Nadi Behuda. He disagrees very often with the Chassam Sofer, with many poskim. So there was a certain rabbi in the New York area who was also learning Talmud Chacham, who wrote a whole Sefer attacking Rav Moshe Feinstein, how arrogant a person he is, that he takes on to disagree with the Nadi Behuda and the Chassam Sofer. Does he think that he's greater in learning than them? Anybody who knew Rav Moshe Feinstein, he was such a humble. He was humble, ridiculously humble. Not humble, he was extremely humble. He was friendly with everybody. He didn't have a shemitz of arrogance. Rav Moshe Feinstein was so hurt when that book was published by the rabbi. So he said, I don't think I'm greater than the Chassam Sofer. I don't think I'm greater than Nadi Behuda. I don't know if I'm entitled to an opinion. Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But the rabbanim are pressuring me. They want to know my opinion. So I have to give my honest to goodness opinion, even if it's in disagreement with those who are greater than me. That's the halacha. The Talmid Chacham has to give his opinion. And you do have a right to disagree with those who preceded. In the later generations, we can't disagree with Rabbeinu Rav Ashi, Sofer HaYiroah. You can't disagree with those who have the higher level those who have a stronger status of Chachmei HaMasorah, those who came before Rabbi Nahum Rashi, where the Torah Shel Baal Peh was still being transmitted in Baal Peh. But we're talking about this evening with the Ne'eri Behuda, with the Chassam Sofer, that's all after the days of Rabbi Nahum Rashi. So that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. You have a right to disagree with Gaonim also. The Gemara has this, that the Bais Rishon lasted for 410 years, that says in Novi. And then there was a Churban Bais Rishon for 70 years. And then they built the second Beis HaMikdash. Ezra Nechemiah built the second Beis HaMikdash. And there were many old-timers. I'm 80 years old. There were people 80 years old, 85 years old. They remembered the way they did the Hakrovas HaKarbonas and the Bais Rishon. It says in Tanakh, it says, very strange, it says, the younger people were singing and dancing and rejoicing when they built the second Beis HaMikdash because they never saw Beis HaMikdash before. The older people were crying because how does this compare to the first Beis HaMikdash? They were missing so many things. They're missing, major things were missing in the Bais Sheni. So the Psukim say you couldn't hear the singing and the rejoicing of the younger people because there were so many older people who were crying. They drowned out the rejoicing and the singing of the younger people. How could that be? Not to be, but that's what it says in Tanakh. That's what it says in the Tanakh. So there was a major change made. How you did Nisach Hayayin. They did Nisach Hayayin during the Bais Rishon also. But the Gemara says in Bais Rishon they did it one way. Then the Bais Sheni, 7 years later, they hung up a shingle. Under new management, we're going to do the Nisach Hayayin differently. So the Sfasemis is a Sefer HaKodshim that everybody uses by the Ger Rebbe. He was the grandson of the first Ger Rebbe, the Chedush HaRim. So the Sfasemis on the Gemara in Zvachim asked the Kashi, mean for 410 years they were never Yotze the Mitzvah Nisach Hayayin properly because he always did it incorrectly. We do it the way they did it in the second, for so many years they did it the way they did second Beis HaMikdash. So the answer is no. That's what it means, Eilu V'Eilu Divrei Kim Chaim. Whatever the Talmid HaChachamim in that generation paskin, that's the Emes, that's the Psak. So during the Bais Rishon, the majority, the consensus was to do the Nisach Hayayin one way. Then it came 7 years later, they knew what the precedent was. There were many old-timers who remembered the way they did Nisach Hayayin, but the Talmid HaChachamim, who were in charge of the second Beis HaMikdash, felt otherwise. And we have the right to disagree with 410 years of precedent. They have the right to give a Psak Fakir. There's one interesting passage where the Rambam disagrees with the Gaonim, then he does give in to the Gaonim. This year is the Shnas HaShmita. So the Gemara says, it's a question, how do you read the Psuk in the beginning of Parshas Bahar? It says, every seventh year of Shmita, and after 49 years, you observe seven Shmitas, then the 50th year is Yovel. So the account 7777 Le'olam Void, and then after 49 years, the next year is going to be Yovel, and then there are only going to be 5 years of planting. Because instead, Yovel is going to be the first year of the next unit of 7 years. So the first year of that Shemitah cycle is going to be Yovel, and the seventh year is going to be Shemitah. You only have 5 years in between. What do you say? No, Yovel is a blank year. You don't count 7-7, you count 50-50. So the seventh year, the 14th year, the 21st year is going to be Shemitah. Then the 50th year is Yovel. Then you start counting all over again, another 50. So we pass on Halacha Lemaisa that Yovel is a blank year, you count 50-50. So after in the days of the Gaonim, they said that today the din is different for some reason or another, and you only count 7777. So that's why in all the calendars it says that this year, Tav Shin Pei Beis, and Shnas HaYovel, Kifi Shitas HaGaonim, according to the opinion of the Gaonim, because the Rambam would disagree. The Rambam says, no, you have to stick in a lot of Yovels. You have to figure out when was the last Yovel, and count that as a blank year, and then every 50 years, stick in another year. So the Rambam disagrees. He says, the Shitas HaGaonim absolutely doesn't make any sense at all. But he says, here he's going to give in to the Gaonim, because the Gaonim lived in Eretz Yisrael. There were Gaonim in Eretz Yisrael. There were Gaonim in Bavel. They weren't all such Gaonim. The name of the yeshiva was Yeshivas Gaon Yaakov, the pride of the Jewish people, Gaon Yaakov. So whoever was the president of the yeshiva was called Rosh Yeshiva's Gaon Yaakov. So just like, let's say, in Yeshiva University, not every president was such a big Talmid Chacham. We had a president, a very fine fellow, Mr. Richard Joel. He'd be the first one to tell you. He never learned for Smicha. He didn't learn in yeshiva. He's a fine balabas, a good baltfilah, but he wasn't a talmid chacham. I'll be the first one to tell you. So many of the gaonim in the days of Gaonim, they were fundraisers. Some of them are not so learned. Most of the famous ones were very learned. So the Rambam says over here, the gaonim lived in Eretz Yisrael. We don't live in Eretz Yisrael. They lived in Eretz Yisrael, and that's why all the Jews observed the din like that. So here he says we have to follow the precedent. And we have to follow the Gaon to do 7-7 Le'olam Vo'ad. The Ravid disagrees often with the Rambam. So the Ravid disagrees and says, no, I think we should paskan like the Rambam. Rav Soloveitchik said that to the best of his recollection, this is the only place where the Ravid disagrees with the Rambam, says you should paskan like the Rambam. And the Rambam says, you're not paskan like me. He gives in to the Gaonim. But that's rare that the Rambam gives in. Usually the Rambam disagrees with the Gaonim. He doesn't follow precedent. Mishnah Berurah didn't follow precedent. Chazon Ish didn't follow precedent. The Express, Rav Moshe Feinstein didn't follow precedent. And every generation, Talmidei Chachamim investigate the issue all over again. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees to it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed Adam Rishon how the Torah is going to be developed over the years. That's what Sefer Shel Adam Rishon is all about. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will see to it that the Torah should be developed in the direction that he wants it to go. Behind the scenes, he's going to see to it that everything should go the way he wants. It's interesting. The Shach is one of their major commentaries, both on Yeridah and Chosh Mishpat. So in the Shach and the Chosh Mishpat, for many, many years, Shach lived in the 1600s. So for many years, there were a few places in the Shach and Chosh Mishpat that the sentence just didn't read straight at all. And about 50 years ago, a Jewish person bought an apartment in Manhattan. I don't know, maybe near Stern College. I don't remember, they tell you where it was. He bought the apartment from a non-Jew, and then there were a couple of books on the floor. So the non-Jew told him he has no use for those books. If you want to keep it, if you don't want to throw it out. One of the books was the original manuscript of the Shach on Chosh Mishpat. No one knows how it arrived in Manhattan. No one knows how come it was sitting on the floor over there. And they finally got to understand that those 10 places in the Shach that no one ever understood. What happened was, he wrote his commentary, and then he felt that he had to add something in. So on the side of the column, he wrote on the margin, he put an asterisk in his commentary. Then on the side, he wrote a few lines. So the printer who set the type didn't realize that the whole 5 lines has to be added in that location where the asterisk is. So he didn't do that. So he set the type as if it's one big line. What was written on the margin, the 5 lines, on the first line goes with the first line, second line goes with the second line. So absolutely didn't make any sense at all. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw to it that original manuscript of the Shach, they know the Shach's handwriting, so they knew to identify this is really the Shach's authentic handwriting. That was his original copy of his commentary on Chosh Mishpat. So they saw to it that after so many centuries, they set the type anew and they corrected those 10 places in the Chosh Mishpat where the lines just didn't make any sense. No one ever knew what the Shach was talking about over there. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees to it that after years everything will be straightened out. There are those who say, there are those people who think that they're historians, and they say the Amoraim misunderstood the Tanoim. They understand better what the Tanoim are saying. The Rishonim misunderstood the Amoraim. The Acharonim misunderstood the Rishonim. Everybody had a bad gear, so everything is all full of mistakes. The whole Torah, as we observe, is all full of mistakes, but everything is binding anyway because that's what the Halacha is all about. That's not what the halacha is all about. The halacha is binding because we assume that there are no mistakes. And if you find a mistake, you don't follow that psak. The Shach changes the psak. The Mishnah Berurah changes the psak on every page. The Shach changes the psak on every page. Those are on Shulchan Aruch. Magen Avraham disagrees very often. We don't follow a mistake. If you ascertain that something is a mistake, you don't follow. We follow the Piskei Dinim that we handed down over the generations on the assumption we should assume that Sod Hashem Lireyav, that everything that they paskin was correct, but once you ascertain that something is incorrect, you're not allowed to follow that. We say that it wasn't correct, it wasn't Sod Hashem Lireyav. The Pasuk tells us in Divrei HaYomim, that towards the end of the Vicerishan period, one of the kings was Yoshio HaMelech. He was a prominent individual. So Yoshio HaMelech was going as the Oren with the Luchas, with the Tzitzenes Haman, with the Shemin HaMishcha in the basement of the Beis HaMikdash. Why did he do that? What motivated him to take from the, instead of the Oren with the Luchas being in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he put it in a chamber in the basement based on the Megillah B'Ksav. David HaMelech, every time David HaMelech wanted to build a Beis HaMikdash, every time he was victorious in battle and he would take possession of gold and silver and copper and precious metal, he would always be Magdash everything. He would consecrate it for the purpose of using it for the Beis HaMikdash. Then after winning so many battles and having so much precious metal, he wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, so the Navi told him, you're not permitted to. The Beis HaMikdash has to be a Makom Shalom. He tells him, Dam Rab Shafachta. David HaMelech killed a lot of Palestinian terrorists. He did a big mitzvah. There were Palestinians that pushed him. There were big terrorists. They were right for him. But Sof Kol Sof, he killed a lot of people. So the Beis HaMikdash has to be built B'Shalom. Beis HaMikdash on the Sati Shalom HaMakom HaZeh. Beis HaMikdash has to be a Makom Shalom. So the Navi told David HaMelech, he's going to have his son Shlomo. He's going to be in Ishalom. He's going to build a Beis HaMikdash. So the Navi had originally given him the Megillah B'Ksav with the layout, with the blueprint of the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says, HaKol B'Ksav Mi'ad HaShem Alay Haskel. It's a pasuk in Divrei HaYomim. Gemara says, you're not allowed to change anything from the blueprint. You have to build everything exactly the way it's described in the Megillah B'Ksav. And David HaMelech had to transmit this Megillah B'Ksav to his son Shlomo HaMelech. On Chanukah, you know, that at the end of the davening, we usually say, Mizmashir Chanukah Slabayis from David. And people don't understand, what does it have to do with Chanukah Slabayis? When there's a chayla, when someone is not well and they want to say tilm, so usually say Mizmashir Chanukah Slabayis from David, because he says there, he took sick, and then he prayed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered his prayers, and he got better. So it's a tefillah that you say for a chayla who needs a refuah shleima. What does it have to do? It doesn't say a word about the Chanukah Habayis. Why is that the Mizmashir Chanukah Habayis LeDavid? So Rav Velvel Soloveitchik explains in his sefer based on the Yalkut Shemayni. Yalkut Shemayni explains that David HaMelech was given the Megillah B'Ksav by the Navi, and he was told he has to transmit it to his son Shlomo HaMelech Ba'amida in a standing position, just like when you makriv karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohanim have to be in his standing position. They have to stand when they duchen, they have to stand when they makriv karbanos. And if the Kohanim are makriv the karbanos in his sitting position, the karbanos are posel, you have to do it over again. So the Megillah B'Ksav had to be transmitted from David to his son Shlomo in his standing position. He was so sick, he couldn't even get out of bed to stand up for a minute. So he prayed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give me your refuah shleima, at least I should be able to stand up for a minute, to give the Megillah B'Ksav to my son. So that's why the Mizmashir Chanukah Habayis L'Tfilah, that he should get better, he should recover from his inability to stand up, was what enabled him to transmit the Megillah B'Ksav to his son Shlomo, that enabled Shlomo to build the Beis HaMikdash. So what motivated Yoshio HaMelech to be going as the Luchas in the basement? The Gemara says, in the original plan, in Megillah B'Ksav, that the Navi gave to David, David gave to Shlomo, and that plan, it said there are two locations to put the Aron, either in the Kodesh Kadoshim, or when time comes, when it will be necessary, they should put it in the chamber in the basement. So what happened? What changed? So it's very unclear. In the Pesukim Dirayam, it's very unclear. It wasn't that he was concerned that the enemy may come and capture the Aron with the Luchas. It doesn't say that, it says something else. So the Netziv explains in his... The Netziv wrote a whole long essay about the transmission of the Torah Shebaal Peh. It's a beautiful long essay. Very long essay. So he interprets the psukim as follows. Yoshua Melech understood that the Bais Rishon is going to, the Nevi'im told him, the Bais Rishon is going to be destroyed. And Kol's Ban the Sanhedrin is sitting in the Lishkan Sagozes because they're close to the Aron, so they have a Hashua Sashchina that guides them and helps them not to make any mistakes. They have a Siyata Rishmaya, and they need a big Siyata Rishmaya because their psukim are binding on all of Klal Yisrael. So Yoshua HaMelech understood that we're going to have to develop a new Derech HaLimud, because this Derech HaLimud, you just sit near the Oren and you get a Siyata Rishmaya and you come up with the right answer, it's not going to last for long. The bi-speaking is going to be charev. So the derech alema that they developed later was pilpul shel Torah, that you have a machlekes, and this one says one way, and he brings rayas from Chumash and from Mishnayos and so on, back and forth. The way they write tshuvas, the way they write Moshe Feinstein wrote tshuvas, Rabbi Yehuda, all the generation, they write tshuvas with pilpul shel Torah, with a lot of machlekes. So he intentionally took the Oren with the Luchas, put it in the basement, so the Sanhedrin should not have that Siyag Tadishmai anymore. So the Sanhedrin should get used to the new style of learning, that you have to argue everything out until you come to a correct conclusion. That's the Derech Halima that we have now, but we believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is guiding us now also. We observe the mitzvahs. The Rambam writes what he considers are the 13 Ikori Hamuna. We have it in the Siddur, after Shachris, the 13 Ani Mamins. That's based on the Rambam in his Pirush HaMishnayis and Masechah Sanhedrin. So the Rambam writes that we believe HaTorah HaMetzuya Ata B'Yodeinu Hi HaNesuna LaMoshe Abeinu. That the way we observe the mitzvahs, we assume that this is the correct way. Not that the Amoraim misunderstood the Tanoim and the Rishonim had the wrong gears, and the Achroinim misunderstood the Rishonim, and everything was one big mistake. But the Halacha is binding anyway. The Halacha is not binding if it's a mistake. The Halacha is only binding on the assumption that it's not a mistake. We assume that it's not a mistake because Hayda Hashem L'Re'ah, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us that. So we believe that the way we observe the mitzvahs is emes, it is correct. If we will discover that we're making a mistake, if we'll discover the original manuscript of the Shach and we'll understand that he said something other than when we understood, so we're going to change the psak right away. When you find that something is a mistake, you have to change it right away. You don't leave things that are not correct. These are important ideas. Emes plays a very crucial role in paskening shalas and observing mitzvahs. Rav Chaim Volozhiner has, after he passed away, so they put together a collection of tshuvas by Rav Chaim Volozhiner. It's called Chut HaMishulosh. Has tshuvas by Rav Chaim Volozhiner and two of his sons-in-law, who were also rabbeim in Volozhiner Yeshiva. Rav Chaim Volozhiner was the most outstanding student of the Vilna Gaon, and he founded Volozhiner Yeshiva. That was the first yeshiva in Lithuania. Like this, they never had yeshivas. The rabbi in every community would learn with a couple of boys. It wasn't an official yeshiva. Volozhin, they came from all over to learn in Volozhin. So Rav Chaim Volozhin founded the yeshiva in 1801 after the death of the Vilna Gaon. The yeshiva lasted till 1892 or so, lasted for 9 years, and it was closed by the Russian government, also a parsha bifnei atzma. So Rav Chaim Volozhin signs off his tshuvas. Very often he signs off, Kel emes, nosan lo natoras emes, bilti elo emes einenu. When we're figuring out how to observe the mitzvahs, we're searching for the emes. And even though Rashi said it, if Tosfos bops Rashi over the head, Tosfos disagrees. The Baal Yad Tosfos were Rashi's grandchildren, and they often disagree with the grandfather, Rabbi Natan, and all of his children, and all of his nephews, and so on. They're all descendants from Rashi. We don't always follow Rashi. We don't always follow Tosfos. We follow the consensus on the assumption, Nachar Rab Nahatis, that the consensus is going to be correct, and if we find that we made a mistake, we reverse the psak right away. You have to correct it. We all know from our grandparents, who knew from their parents and their grandparents, all of the traditions in the Torah, we know what's true. We know that the seven bones never existed. That was a dream. We know Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov Moshe Rabbeinu did exist. We know which stories are true, which stories are not true. And we follow the halacha because we assume the halacha is emes. We assume that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu. And over the generations, the Torah Shemal Peh has developed the halacha further and further. We assume there was a divine assistance, clearly a Seyaita Rishmaya, that the Talmid HaChachamim shouldn't make a mistake. And when they would make a mistake, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to see to it that in the future it will be straightened out. So these are important ideas. We have to realize that our religion is all based on emes. Whatever is not correct, we will reject. When the Torah was originally given, Har Sinai, the whole world was full of superstitions. And the Rabbi Shalom said, Lo se nachshu v'lo se onenu. So at that time, the Jews were at the forefront of fighting against superstitions. Now, in our generation, you get the impression as if the Jews are the most superstitious of all the people, because we have such a baggage of minhagim. that were instituted years ago, centuries ago, and a lot of them in Hagen no longer apply today. So Rabbi Yisrael Samuel of Hirsch has a beautiful essay where he writes, the Rabbanim have to investigate all of the Minhagim. Do the Minhagim still make sense today? He says that just like Karbanis, if you have Kachikachim, so it's Nipsa Belina, if you leave it overnight till tomorrow morning, it's already possible. Kachim Kalim is a lower level of Kedusha, so Kachim Kalim is Shlamim. If you leave it overnight till the next day, you can eat the Kachim Hashnei Yamim Lailecha. So the more Mekudish the Karban is, so the more time sensitive it is, the more it'll become puzzle. If you leave it overnight till after Chatzos, it'll become puzzle. So he says, holy menhagim have to be reinvestigated in every generation. Do they still make sense? A lot of people still continue to observe menhagim that used to make sense. Maybe they made sense centuries ago, but if they don't longer make sense today, you're supposed to drop all the menhagim. If you have a takana de rabbanon that was made for a certain reason, even if the Gemara says, even if you live in a generation, well, the reason no longer applies, the takana de rabbanon still applies. But by minhagim, we don't say like that. All the poskim said, by minhagim, if the minig no longer makes any sense, you don't observe the minig. In Europe, in Germany, in Hungary, by the Yekis and by the Hungarians, they had a minig on Pesach, they wouldn't eat chicken, they would only eat flesh. Why? Because they used to feed chicken kernels of grain. And the kernels of grain, when it went into the stomach, sometimes they would turn into chametz. So if you shech the chicken, right after you ate the kernels of grain, and then you would cook the chicken in a pot. So today, we cook chicken in a pot, but we don't leave the belly in. We throw the belly, nobody cooks. Years ago, they used to cook the chicken with the belly. So Tosfos has this whole discussion, the Shulchan Aruch they have it. You cook the chicken on Pesach, and then you look in the pot, and you find they just cooked kernels of grain with hot water. You said, just made it chametz. You were cooking kernels of grain with hot water, basically into chametz. So in Hungary and in Germany, they had a minig, you don't eat chicken on Pesach, right? You only eat flesh, so you can never fall in with this. But today, nobody in the world, in the normal cup, nobody feeds grain to the chickens. They feed them corn on the cup. They feed them maize. Maize is kidneys. Kidneys is bottle berai. You don't even eat shishim. So the whole minig doesn't apply today. Even those Yekis, even those Hungarians who had such a minig in Europe, the Rabbanim say, you don't have to observe that minig anymore. Many other menhagim also. A minig that no longer makes any sense, you don't observe. A lot of people are so superstitious, they think a minig has to be observed. It depends which minig, you have to ask the Rabbanim. Our religion is a religion of truth. It says, by Amida Bashem, of Moshe Avdoi. What do you mean? You have to believe in Moshe Rabbeinu, he's standing in front of you. What does that pasuk mean? It means, they knew that Hashem existed. We all know that Hashem exists. We have a historical tradition from our ancestors who witnessed Esa Makas, and they witnessed Kriyas Yamsuf, and they witnessed Maimah Hasina. We have a clear historical tradition that Hashem exists. But a lot of times you have information in the back of your mind, and you don't have it in the forefront of your mind. A lot of times I have to fill out some form. So I have to write down, what's my social security number? I don't remember my social security. My wife knows my social security number. I don't remember the social security number. So it takes me, if I'll sit and concentrate for a long time, I'll remember it. But it's not in the forefront of my mind. So the pasuk says, like, Amina Bashem of Moshe Abdu, just like Moshe Abena was right in front of their eyes. So they believed in Hashem as if he's in front of their eyes. Not just it was something in the back of their mind, stored away, that Hashem exists. It was Shavisa Hashem Lenegdi Samit. That's what the mitzvah means. To believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't mean to believe. How can you believe? What are you talking about? Not we believe. We have a historical tradition that God exists and he's in full control of everything in the world, and all of Yud Gimel Yikorei Emunah were demonstrated on the occasion of Yetzias Mitzrayim and Maim HaSinai. Everything is a fact. But it shouldn't be in the back of your mind. It should be like you see Moshe Rabbeinu in front of your eyes. Ve'amid HaShem to the same extent. It should always be Shivisi HaShem Lenegdi Samet. Our religion is a religion of emes. We should always remember that. Okay? Maybe we'll open the floor for discussions or questions.
Me and Nachsho, I'm going to be the first opportunity to ask. Yes?
By some now.
When someone is in a position of like being a counselor or an advisor, or just being in a position that they have hashpa on people younger than you, who are not necessarily as strong in their Yiddishkeit, how does Rebbe suggest that one goes about balancing between staying strong in your Yiddishkeit, but risking the chance of having less hashpa, versus potentially being over on averos, but being able to have more of an influence on the children who need it.
The yeshiva every couple of years celebrates. In yeshiva, they celebrate every few years the Chag HaSmicha. We were just talking about it before. So when I was a student in the yeshiva, Rabbi Soloveitchik was always the main speaker of the Chag HaSmicha. Dr. Belkin would speak officially. Dr. Belkin was the Rosh Yeshiva, and Rabbi Soloveitchik just the Magid Shir. So Dr. Belkin was not a good public speaker. He used to speak for 10, 15 minutes, very quickly, and he always had good content, but he wasn't an orator. And then he would introduce Rabbi Soloveitchik, he'd always give a major address. I remember every time at the Chag HaSmicha there was a different Russian. Same thing when there would be a funeral, when a prominent Talmid Chacham would die and Rabbi Soloveitchik would deliver a hesped, he would always pick out one midah that this person was known for, and he would give a whole drasha on that midah. We should identify that person with the midah that he was known for, and he would give a hesped for a major address every time. So I remember in one Chag HaSmicha, Rabbi Soloveitchik was encouraging the Rabbanim, they shouldn't develop a Messiah complex. They shouldn't think that they're going to save the whole world. So therefore, they can cut corners a little bit over here. You can make a, let's say, the bus going, taking the kids to the Enseraswai Shabbaton is slow, and there's traffic, and it's Erev Shabbos, and it's after the Shkia already, so you'll be makel. You can have the goy drive the bus. You shouldn't be makel on anything. You have to follow all the dinim. You shouldn't cut corners. You have to find. We shouldn't think that we're going to accomplish so much. Shouldn't, like he said, shouldn't develop a Messiah complex. So he was telling the boys who were getting the smicha, he said, if you'll accomplish that, to send three boys to the yeshiva from your community, that's gewaldic. If you get one or two families to become Shomer Shabbos, that's gewaldic. That's a tremendous accomplishment. Don't think that you're going to accomplish to get the whole world to do tshuva. If you accomplish a little less, it's also gewaldic. We shouldn't think that we can cut corners a little bit in order to accomplish more. Now, in Yiddish, the Rabbanim always used to say, the Jewish people are obligated to do, not to oifton. We're not obligated to accomplish results. We have to try the best under the circumstance without violating any of the laws. You have to be careful to observe all the mitzvahs, even if it means that we'll have less influence. We have to be honest individuals, so they'll see the honesty that we have, they'll see the integrity that the religious Jews have. So people will be impressed by our, if we have integrity, people will be impressed by our honesty and our integrity. What's the issue of Kol Isha with respect to?
To Heter Kiro.
Heter?
Kiro. Like, I heard from someone that, like, it's okay for, like, girls to sing along to Havdalah and so on with the guys and everything.
Yeah. You may have heard of the author of the Sri Deyesh, Rabbi Weinberg. So he was brought up in Lithuania. He learned in Slabodka with the big Bali Musa. And then at a certain point in his life, he moved, he divorced his wife, he left her behind, he was not happily married, and then that was a tragedy. And then he moved to Germany, and he was surprised that he didn't come with his wife, so he always ate by other families. So he was surprised to see that it was known that the Yekis were so from, and they would sing Zmiras, so the boys and the girls would sing together. So he was stunned. How can it be? They're so observant. So they told them both that both Rabbi Azriel Hildesheim and Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch had the two big yeshivas in Frankfurt and in Berlin. They both allowed it based on earlier poskim, based on the Chidov in the 1700s, based on a combination of two ideas. That some poskim say that Kol Isha doesn't apply for singing Shirei Kodesh, singing Zmiras. And then another svar is that Trei Koli La Mishtami. If a few people are singing together, so you don't really hear anyone's voice. So if you have everybody singing Zmiras together, you used to have the boys and the girls sing Zmiras together, so they allowed that. Then after the war, so the some of the young teenage survivors after the war started groups, like here in America, they have Shama Hadati, When I was a little boy in Pennsylvania, I used to go to Shomer HaDati. That was, I used to walk every Shabbos 45 minutes to the other side of town in order to get together with other religious kids. That was Mechazek Kas all the time. Then Shomer HaDati turned into Bnei Akiva later on. So they had such a thing in Europe also. So they went, especially a representation of that group went to ask whether they can have these youth groups on Shabbos afternoon, whether they can have the boys and the girls sing Zmiris together. So he wrote the tshuva where he says that they had what to rely on, that was a reasonable psak. It's not that you make a, that was the psak, that if you have the combination of both svaris together, you have trei kol ilo mishtami, and you have the shirei kodesh, that there's no issa, that it's not prohibited. In Lithuania they never did it. But the Sridi Yesh writes, in Lithuania, the girls were not so from. In Eastern Europe, you could have in the same family, the boys would go to with their father to the Rebbe's Tish, Achsidish Rebbe's Tish, Vishalushudis, and the girls, the sisters, would go to the movies with the Goyish girlfriends on Shabbos afternoon, in the same family. And the girls didn't have any official Jewish education. They were not so observant at all. That's why they started the Vesanka movement, because it was terrible. And somehow in Western Europe, the girls were more observant than in Eastern Europe. So that's what the Sridi Yesh writes. He thinks that the Germans had understood psychology better than the Polish Jews, and they felt that relying on this psak, that Trei Kol Ilo Mishtami, is the way of the future. That's the way to go. He has another truth about how high the mechitza has to be. So he writes that the shaila began in America, because in Europe they always had a balcony, the women's section was upstairs. In America they had the men and the women on the same level. So he writes it was a machloikis between the Satmar Rebbe and Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he says he personally thinks that if you're going to have the mechitza going to be so high, goes till the ceiling, the women are going to feel so excluded from the davening, they're not going to be interested in observing the mitzvahs. You have to have a lower mechitza. It should be a little reasonable. So he thinks that it's more reasonable to follow Rav Moshe Feinstein in this situation. In every generation, the Rabbanim have to give a reasonable psak based on the circumstances and based on the traditions. So there is sufficient tradition to be lenient over here. The more Jews who will live in Eretz Yisrael, so the safer the country will be, so the less trouble we'll have from the Arabs. If the Jews are not living in Eretz Yisrael, so the Arabs want it. Why do we steal it there? Why do we steal it from there? But if the whole Eretz Yisrael will be packed with Jews, so the Arabs can't take it away. Yeah, in every generation, there are certain mitzvahs that, even though they're not as important as others, but in that generation, that's a very important mitzvah. The Yish of Eretz Yisrael is today is one of the more important mitzvahs.
Is it okay to take art history classes that involve pictures with Avodah Zarah and sculptures with Avodah Zarah? You are, yes.
To study Avodah Zarah is not permissible. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says about himself, he is a jealous God, Kikil Kana Hashem. Sometimes you have a husband who's very jealous, he doesn't want his wife to talk to any other men. Or a wife is jealous, she doesn't want her husband to speak in Stern College. Whatever. My wife went to a wedding tonight, that's right. Otherwise she would come to watch me to make sure that I don't start off with anybody. So, Ibn Shalom doesn't want us to display any interest in Avodah Zarah at all. Gemara says you're not allowed to look at a religious painting if it's from an Avodah Zarah. Let's say you have the Mother Mary with the baby, with the whatever they have in their religion. You're not allowed to study. You're not allowed to go into a church to see the architecture. And near the yeshiva in Washington Heights, they have the cloisters. So I think the cloisters is a church that was moved over from Spain, if I'm not mistaken. So once, many years ago, students wanted to go on a trip to go visit the cloisters. It's a 10-minute walk from the yeshiva. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said it's not permissible. It's a pasuk in the Chumash, al tifna al ha'alilim. You're not permitted to display any interest at all in anything that has to do with Avodah Zarah. So that's not right. To study nudes, that's not the Jewish way. That was the Greeks. The Greeks felt beauty is an important thing. And the Jewish, we feel beauty is also important, but more important is midas tovus. I remember when I was dating, so I never discussed with my roommates or with the other boys in the dormitory, the girls that I was dating. I mentioned before that I haven't come to Stern College. I used to come for dates to the dormitory. That was over 55 years ago. I got married 55 years ago. So I wouldn't discuss the girls that I was dating, but sometimes the other boys would hear that I'm dating a certain girl, so they would give their opinion. So they said, this girl is absolutely stunning. She's beautiful. The other girl's not good looking. And when I would date them, I would have the opposite impression, because I wouldn't just judge the way the girl looks. I would talk to the girl. So a lot of girls whom they thought were not good looking, I thought they were very attractive. And the ones whom they thought were good looking, a lot of times I thought they didn't have midas tovus. So I didn't feel that they were so good looking. The Greeks placed a lot of emphasis on beauty of the body. And that's why they have all these nude statues all over the place. But we never held from that. That's not right. You should avoid it. That would deserve for sure you should avoid. And the nudes also you should avoid. There's a difference between nakedness and nudity. They're two different things, but still, both of them are not right.
Given how rich the halachic history is, how does Rebbe think that girls should be learning halacha? Only the bottom line halacha, or actually going through the
The women are not obligated to go through the whole thing from the beginning to the end. The women are not only obligated to know the dinim in order to know how to observe the mitzvahs, but we live in a generation that the girls go to university, they go to graduate school. So if they're interested in studying the whole hishtalshlus, how the halacha came to be so why not? You have to make it available. That's why Rabbi Soloveitchik felt that in our generation, you have to make the first one who made Gemara available for the women in the New York area was the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And they were teaching Gemara for women in Crown Heights before Stern College. And the reason why was because he was afraid the women who are going to be interested in Gemara, they're going to go to the Jewish Theological Seminary and then hear a false presentation of Gemara. So he wanted them to hear a correct presentation. So he instituted it. Then Rabbi Soloveitchik encouraged that they should have it here, they should make it available to the girls here. But if a girl is not interested, she just wants to hear the bottom line and she'll read the Shmir Shabbos Kol Chos at the top of the page. She doesn't have to read the bottom of the page. As long as she knows the bottom line, so it's good enough. Not, the women are not obligated. But if they want to learn it, gesunta hey, fine. No, the politics, there was politics in the yeshiva. It wasn't machlokes. Politics. It wasn't exactly machlokes. You should always avoid machlokes. You should always avoid. The Mishnah says, machlokes l'shem shamayim sofer l'hiskayim, but the l'shem shamayim has to be l'shem shamayim. Usually the l'shem shamayim is not l'shem shamayim. You should always avoid all machlokes.
Can't give a one clock.
I was wondering if
Professor
has any thoughts regarding reading or writing for the observer or the commentator.
the why you observer.
I have to apologize. I haven't looked in the observer or the commentator in a few years.
Is that my answer?
No, love in my head is so much better. I really don't. Okay. I really don't.
Is it for women to dive into
Tefillah
B'Tzibur?
You stand a better chance of having your prayers answered if you dive into Tefillah B'Tzibur. The Gemara gives a mashal, a person buys one apple, turns out that it's a rotten apple, he can ask for his money back. But if he buys a whole bushel full of apples and some of them are rotten, that's self-understood, that they're not all going to be so gevaldig. So the Gemara says, maybe your prayers, maybe you are the rotten apple. So maybe you don't deserve that your prayer should be answered. But if you daven with the whole tzibur, so Rabbeinu Shlom has to accept the rotten apple together with the other apples. That's why the Gemara speaks about the significance of being koveya mokam l'tfilosa. That's a person davening at home should always daven in the same location. Why? So the commentaries explain, if you daven in the same location, means it's an indication of one's humility. I feel maybe my prayers don't deserve to be answered. So I want to daven in this location where I davened yesterday and the day before. I want today's prayer to be combined with all the previous prayers that we davened there. The whole idea of praying is you want a Kodesh Baruch Hu to take care of your needs. So if you stand a better chance of having your prayers answered if you daven Tefillah B'Tzibur, so it's better to daven Tefillah B'Tzibur. Look, if it's just going to ruin the whole day, you have to wake up early, you have homework, you have to stay up late at night. It was going to ruin your whole day, so that doesn't make any sense. But whenever it's possible, you should try to daven Tefillah B'Tzibur.
To follow up on the previous question, how much should learning Torah for women be prioritized, or maybe it should be prioritized over secular subjects?
The women have to know halacha and have to know emunah. Have to know the mitzvah of Amunah, to know what are the Ikari Amunah. If they'll be satisfied with the ABCs that they got in elementary school and high school, okay, but it's always better to develop a little further, to be more careful about the Dikdukei HaMitzvahs, to follow all the details of the mitzvahs and to know the Hashkafa a little deeper than just the superficial understanding. My daughters, I have 6 daughters and 3 sons. They're all married. They have their own children now. My daughters were never interested in studying Gemara. But now they're all married and they live Arba Kampus Aretz. They live all over the world. And now they attend Shiurim. If it's someone who's giving substance, so they'll listen to the Shiur. Stamad Rasha, a pilpul, they're not interested in. You don't have to do all the learning now before you get married. You can do learning later on. Everything is available now on the internet. So you don't even have to grab everything now while you're in Stern College. You have a whole lifetime ahead. You have another 100 years ahead of you. Everyone should try to develop a little more in Hashkofe, in Amuna, in Halacha L'maisa. But strictly speaking, if the woman has amunah, nikore amunah, and she knows the basics of the mitzvah, so not mechuyev to learn more than that. Okay, I thank you very much. I think my taxi may be waiting for me.
Okay. I want to say a big thank you to Rav Schechter. Thank you so much for coming down. We appreciate the time and the opportunity to hear Torah from Rav Schechter. And Mitzvah Hashem, we should continue hearing many, many years of Torah from Rav Schechter.
Thank you.